Hello again, this is Kinnack, calling in from the winter wonderland that is Central Ohio. Have some time right now for the 6th Metroplexity podcast, before I, you know, head out to do the whole Christmas thing with family and so forth. So I guess if you're curious, you won't be hearing a ton from me until after Christmas, but I will still try to be dropping in and making sure that nothing explodes on Christmas Day or anything, because that would be kind of sad. Well, let's get to some questions. Let's see, we've got a whole slew from Al. Why are there not etheric versions of the wall turrets and all the other robots turn to crazy etheric stuff? There's actually a very good reason for that, which I'm not going to tell you directly. There are a couple of hints in-game and in a couple of, you know, other even weirder places. Some of which you found, some of which you haven't, one of which you probably don't realize is a hint, that sort of thing. You know the drill, I guess. But yeah, the wall turrets are just the fact that things are robotic tends to make them not show up in the ether. There's an entirely separate phenomenon that results in them being replaced with other crazy stuff. So, take that as you will, I guess. Stream of Needles seems to change. Ah, yes. Yeah, there was a error with Stream of Needles. I changed it a while back from Chain 6 to Chain 7, and it didn't get changed everywhere, so there was a, the Slags guards were using it weirdly. I went ahead and, when I originally saw this question, I went ahead and fixed it. There was another weird one that Al also found with the spider drones punching people, which is just kind of funny in and of itself, but fixed now. Would it be a false assumption to think that all etheric attacks use Will as the associated set? It certainly doesn't have to be that way. It definitely tends to be. So I guess probably not a bad assumption, but don't be surprised if it turns out being wrong. How did the Christmas stuff turn out? Well, it's been going really well. A lot more bugs than I would have wanted. The rollout was automated properly, which is really cool. But the content itself had a lot more flaws in it than I really would have liked. I apologize, by the way, if I periodically cut out. That's me trying to make you not have to listen to me blowing my nose. On the bright side, though, I did get a new desk, so it's not all squeaky anymore. You hear that? That is the lack of my desk squeaking. So, that goes out to, I believe it was Weird who noticed that. Let's see. Oh, but yeah, no, I think it's going really well as far as, like, I think people are really enjoying it and really getting into it. And the stages are coming about the times I thought they would. We'll see if the last little bit rolls out before Christmas. Hope so, but, you know. If not, I guess I just have some stuff in store for next year. Are there still undiscovered forms with the crystalline flames? No tier 2 upgrades without the ether, without either of the Fey Ocean Sight skills? It would be unfair of me to say that there are undiscovered forms. There's some stuff that is coded in that you won't be able to get to for a while. You can probably guess what that is from what I just said. But as far as forms that you can actually get right now, I think they've all been found. Are any opponent psychics? That is to say, they pick their techniques after seeing what techniques they've already chosen? No, absolutely not. What determines opponent's HP? Just a number you mainly enter the database, or is it based on the stats the same way it is for us? You know, I really probably should just base it off their stats. No, I just manually enter it. I feel a little weird basing it off their stats because the players are both way more resilient than a normal human and way less resilient than something like the Midgard SD1, at least in, like, the short term. So it's better in the long run for me to manually enter it. So, like, a PC with, you know, zeros and everything, it still has way more hit points than a bum with zeros and all of their stats, because the PCs are just naturally more resilient for reasons that, you know, there's been some speculation on, but that kind of ties into that. So it's best in the long run probably for me to just keep manually entering them. Why did you put, the age warning on the character creation screen? I'd imagine there's a big market in the 14 to 18 year olds who have large amounts of free time to waste on the internet. Actually, that is an ulterior motive on my part. It's not to not get bitched at about by parents about, like, the drugs and, you know, being able to swear and stuff. Although those are nice. It's actually primarily so that if someone starts pulling stupid bullshit, I can say, well, you know, there's no way for me to tell how old you actually are, but you're certainly not acting like you're 18, so you lied, you know, on the entrance form, which is kind of underhanded to me, from me, but, you know, it just amounts to, you know, the single rule in chat of don't get me involved in your drama, kind of falls into that same category. So if someone's acting like, you know, a spoiled 12-year-old, that is grounds for banning, basically. I haven't had to use it yet, but that's why it's there. I just don't, as, you know, one, well, I mean two people, but Puyo obviously doesn't deal with any of the user-facing stuff, really. But, you know, as a small operation like this, I don't have time to deal with people acting like idiots. So, you know, that's actually why it's there. I mean, there's also some, you know, CYA, because there's some kind of edgy stuff. Certainly nothing that I wouldn't have, then I would object to, you know, my, you know, 14 or even, like, 12-year-old reading. It would probably confuse anyone younger than that. So, and it's certainly nothing worse than what people see on TV every day. Bit more of a moral to the story, really. But, yeah, that's the ulterior motive there is actually why that's there. And obviously, like, I can't tell. So, if you are 14 and act like a responsible adult, there's no way for me to say that you're not, you know, that you're not 18 or, you know, 30. You know, if I had logged into this game when I was, like, 7, I probably would pass myself off easily enough as an 18-year-old that it wouldn't have caused a problem, that sort of thing. Basically, it's just there to say, don't make me question your age and maturity. Oh, that doesn't offend anyone, but that's my my evil ulterior motive there. Let's see, we've got Morwen. Are there plans for more etheric techniques that don't consume turns of etheric? It's hard to use an etheric deck when you burn through energy so quickly with every little technique. Etheric isn't really intended to be your entire deck the same way that, like, melee and ranged are. It certainly can be. It doesn't cause any problems. And to directly answer the question, there are plans for more of those, obviously. Actually, I think I have a couple more coded already, even. But don't quote me on that. But, like, you've already got the, you know, the Summon the Hounds, the Mask, which doesn't require anything like that. And a couple of other kind of tricky ones. But if you're, the way that etheric is designed, it's not hard to mix with the others. I mean, most of your melee or ranged power will be coming from your weapon. Most of your etheric power will be coming from all the other gear. So there's not a lot of tension there. And, you know, the thing you've noticed, which is obviously that, you know, you don't want to go burning through a bunch of etheric terms, turns all the time. But on the flip side of that, like, if you are going with an all-etheric deck, I don't have a lot of problem with asking people to consider whether they actually, you know, want to continue that chain for as long as they do. Like, if you're fighting some random, you know, fang gangers, it's nice to have a option there where you can, you know, pull back intentionally, not forced on you by the game system. This is actually, I'm partially diverging into a comment that Morwen put on the forums that I haven't responded to there yet, but I guess I'm responding to now, asking if etheric techniques could not cost turns of Eclipse if they're, basically, if they're overkilling an enemy. Like, if the enemy's already dead, you're still just, you know, setting them on green fire over and over again. And that's something that I think adds something to the game being in your hands rather than being taken care of from the computer side. And so you can deal with that either by, you know, using a bunch of Eclipse duration, just not caring about it, paying the costs that way, you know, through body and the effort to get the Eclipse duration stuff. Or you can, you know, mix in some non-etheric techniques, you know, change your gear setup a little bit. Or you can actually be a little more careful in the battles and just try not to overshoot and waste energy, which I think all three of those honestly are interesting, and I think they're all more interesting than having the computer do it for you, so I don't think I would end up doing that. But to the actual question here, there will be other, you know, etheric techniques that don't take turns of etheric, but they will mostly be tied into other stuff. If that helps at all. Like, it's not... The entire theme of the etheric attacks is that they have these sort of requirements. You have to be somehow tied into the ether for it to work. And normally that's through Eclipse. Sometimes that's through other, you know, artifacts or, you know, skills. But that's what I've got for you, I guess. Man Mobile, are the ornaments just amusing decoration, or do they do something? Do you ever do anything just for amusing cosmetic effect? The former and yes, apparently. Yeah, they're just there for decoration and EPing. If you mouse over the descriptions in your tree screen, like when you actually, you know, use the tree, and it describes all the ornaments, it will actually tell you where they came from, and there are more ornaments on the way, both, you know, short-term and long-term, so you can kind of, I think it's pretty cool. I don't know, you know, how well it's going to be received or anything, but I really like the idea that you're kind of building up a collection of ornaments that show, you know, how you've participated in Christmas content over the years. And, you know, obviously, like, this is the first year they show up, so there isn't that history yet. But it'll still kind of shine through, like, what you're doing and so forth. I think it's pretty awesome, but, you know, folks might disagree with me. Tech Runner. Why can't I beat those annoying Legion guys to a bloody pulp, or at least to help them that distributing tract that nobody ever reads to the same person again and again is not very eco-friendly? I guess for most of the same reason that You get, you know, Hare Krishnas or various folks of that nature, or, you know, crazy Christian people handing out tracts or so forth. Insofar as if you told them that, they wouldn't listen to you. As far as beating them up, it's not something like the poet, where there's just, you know, one of him, there's just Dave, that's it. Or even really that they'd be scared off for a day after that. If people really want to beat them up, I can, you know, drop that in there, just, but that would be sheerly to blow off steam. Like, that's all you get. That's why that option isn't there, because it doesn't have any real long-term effect. It's really just, you would kill that particular guy, and then, you know, he'd drop a bunch of tracts, and he'd be like, oh, well, that kind of was, you know, counterproductive, but at least I got some XP out of it. That's about where you're at with those guys. They're crazy. Is there anything major we haven't found out about the crystalline flame yet? I want to say yes. There's some interesting underlying stuff on some of the messages that people will spade out over time that isn't, like, major, it's just kind of neat. I almost want to say there's a technique that nobody's found yet. But I guess don't quote me on that. I'd have to double check the wiki to see if anybody's found it. Have you managed to dedicate some brain cycles to the Survivor's Quest lately with the Christmas content going on? No. Like, not at all. Honestly, next year, I think I'm just going to tell people the beginning of October that there will be, that I will start working on new content again in January. Like, that's kind of been how this has gone. I guess I got some work done in November. But even with, I mean, this stuff all kind of got prepped up and then rolled out, but there was so much with, like, oh, you know, the various snowmen replacing random pieces of equipment with the brain staple singles, things like that, and all the other entertaining bugs and not actually bugs and so forth. That it's just been pretty hectic from that side, you know, plus having, you know, various actual family obligations that I really wish I could use Metroplex as an excuse to bail on, but I don't think that that quite flies, unfortunately. That I just haven't gotten a ton done. So, sorry about that, but yeah, it's kind of the state of affairs. How many Walk with the Blind would be considered by you to be enough to warrant Quest for the Blind Legion? I would say probably like 100, but they're not easy to keep track of, because they're a quest item, and they, you know, they vanish whenever anybody resets, so, what I've been planning to do is that, obviously I'm not going to work on that until I have the Survivor's Quest done. That would just be ridiculous. And there's something, there's another, like, questlet, I guess, after the Survivor Quest that I would also like to do, that I think is honestly probably, will, you know, result in less people asking me questions about it, because there isn't an obvious teaser for it, but, will probably be, like, people will be more excited about it in the long term. So, I guess moral of the story there, it'll be coming at some point after the Survivor's Quest, and before, you know, Old Town. But beyond that, I don't have a really great, you know, time frame for when any of those things will happen. So, how many of those books are already out there? I guess I could find out for you. But like I said, I think there are enough, so to speak, to justify it. Or at least, like, people have gotten close enough to figuring out the easy way to get it that, well, I shouldn't say the easy way, the intuitive way to get it, that it's, you know, worth dropping in. Because people will get it to do the quest, so. Let's see. Looks like there are 15 in various people's inventories. And two people have it equipped, so 17 active. So yeah, I guess that's your official answer. So there are 17 minus, you know, the ones that have been rotated out because it's a quest item. So a lot more than that have been created. It's just that's the number that happened to be in play now. Why did you choose fire out of the possible elements as the one to get a separate power listing? You know, I'd love to say that it's because firepower is just begging for that, you know, kind of pun. Really isn't. It does make me giggle just a tiny bit, though. No, it's mostly because fire is the only thing, like, out of the, you know, traditional elements that isn't just another way of saying etheric. Like, there are a lot of ways to do fire damage, but, like, there aren't, you can't really do cold damage without, you know, invoking the ether. It just doesn't work that way, unless, you know, somebody invents, you know, some crazy goo that gets really cold as a chemical reaction or whatever, but it's a really piss-poor kind of attack, unless you have, you know, some sort of magical backing for it, when fire is just so much easier. So yeah, that's really why. I just wanted something for, you know, all of the grenades and Molotov cocktails and so forth of the world to glom onto. The temptation is there to also include electricity, but I kind of like the direction that that's gone without it, so I'm not going to worry about it too much. I think that electricity kind of has its own identity without, you know, having its own power set. But yeah. I guess that's what I've got. It's just, like, fire is so prevalent as a weapon, you know, since the dawn of time, basically. And by the dawn of time there, I mean, like, the dawn of, you know, human civilization, not, like, time. Although, I guess, you know, there were, like, some pretty serious fireworks at the beginning. But I would probably call that something way cooler, like cosmic damage. So you could have, you know, cosmic power and cosmic defense and sound like you're, you know, trapped in a Silver Surfer comic. Is that the power cosmic? Is that right? I'm not really asking anyone, I'm just, you know, talking to myself, but I think it's the power cosmic that the Silver Surfer has. That completely aside, yeah, that's why you've got fire. Any chance of us getting some ice creams or ice cubes from ghoul biting a snowman next year? I mean, most likely you'll get, you know, brain freeze or, like, a chilly mouth effect or something like that. I mean, as much as, you know, ghoul biting things does convert virtually anything into, you know, delicious, delicious cannibal chow, I don't really see that as, you know, turning snowflakes, even particularly evil snowflakes, into ice cream. I don't know. That's just... I feel silly even, you know, using this as a statement, but that just doesn't really jive with me, you know, despite, you know, all of the craziness that's involved there on both sides. It's just... I will endeavor to slip in some sort of interesting effect for that next year, but I don't think you will get either ice cream or ice cubes. Weird has a couple here. Stealing and... the last block was Raziel, Son of Cain, by the way. I'm not sure if I said that out loud or if I was just, you know, glazing over. Alright, Weird's got this next set. Stealing and changing Al's question. Any chance of us being psychic temporarily? That is to say, seeing some or all of the techniques the enemy is going to use before we choose ours? It's not a bad idea. I would have to completely recode combat to do it. I kind of doubt it ever actually happening. If I had some other pressing reason to entirely recode combat, I could see it as happening. What did you want to be when you were little? That's actually kind of an interesting... Well, I mean, the answer to that is a little funny. When I was small, like, you know, maybe 50% of the kids growing up, I totally wanted to be a paleontologist. Which is kind of funny, because most of the kids, like, just kind of say that. They're like, I like dinosaurs, I want to be a paleontologist. I was like, dude, like, digging in dirt, like, dusting off dinosaur bones and, like, preparing them for transport and whatnot. That all actually sounded pretty interesting. I was really, really into dinosaurs. Like, my grasp of Latin from dinosaur name roots was actually really good when I was like 6 or 7, and has unfortunately deteriorated a great deal since then, which is kind of unfortunate, but I guess you'll have that. But from then, like most of the earliest stuff that I remember doing was actually designing games. So, like, I remember finding, I think I was 10 or 12, about 10 when I found it. Now, there was a notebook that I had brought with me when I moved in with my dad, so it would have been before I was 7, and I didn't remember it at all when I was 10, so, you know, that should give you some idea of how old it was, I guess, on its own. And I had this entire game designed out, with, you know, this really, it was this sort of almost like food chainy type arrangement where you had a deck of cards that was shared between the players, and you were trying to have the best assortment of creatures at the end of the game. But you could only play a certain number of creatures a turn, and the creatures ate stuff. I guess there were some plants in there too, so a certain number of just cards a turn. But the creatures, you know, ate things. So, I was obviously, like, into it enough when I was young that I had this sort of concept that you wanted to design a game that had a distinct arc throughout the gameplay, because you had this very different approach from when, you know, you started. You were trying to build up, basically, you know, like, base goods. Like, there were gourds that you could feed to crickets, that you could feed to snakes, just a reference to something Small Me had seen in China, which I guess puts this at about 6 or 7. So you would play, like, all of your gourds. And then, as the game is getting towards its conclusion, which was just when the deck ran out of cards, you would switch over to playing, like, second tier of creatures. So, like, you know, the crickets. And you would get enough crickets out there so that, you know, you could really just blow up the last couple of turns with playing, like, all the snakes. And there were a bunch of different paths like that. Like, there was, you know, cheese that mice ate, that, you know, the cats ate the mice, and the owls also ate the mice. And I think the owls might have eaten the snakes that ate the crickets, too. There was a lot of, like, a lot of weird stuff going on there that a kid me, I don't think, had a really good idea of, like, how to visually represent that. It was all just texted out. But you could do it pretty cleverly with, like, just cards with point values and icons. It wouldn't be hard at all. But, yeah. So, like, pretty much, I moved on from paleontologist straight to game designer. This is the moral of the story. So, I guess I'm kind of doing what I wanted to do when I grew up. So, that's pretty cool. So, even if, you know, I don't end up, you know, being able to make ends meet without moving somewhere else, I think that's pretty cool. On a slightly related note, just because I think this is friggin' awesome, my wife, when she was little, wanted to be a volcanologist. Like, she actually wanted to go, like, investigate, you know, erupting and, like, lava-full volcanoes. She thought that was the coolest thing ever. And I tend to agree. Like, I think that that's a fair amount more badass than the wanting to be a paleontologist, or at least a lot more, like, notable. What do you think three of the most prominent gangs have animals in their names? The Hounds, Penguins, and Jumbucks. Jumbucks? Jumbucks are an animal? I just thought that was a nonsense word. Like, C.S. Lewis. Jumbuck. Jumbuck. Jumbuck is an Australian term for sheep. Huh. You learn something new every day. The world is also an Australian Aboriginal word for cloud. Oh, which, yeah, kind of makes sense. All right, it's also the name of a call in the mobile chatting community. Huh. Did not know that. All right. I think that... Okay, this is gonna, you know, go straight off the deep end. So, if you don't want to listen to the crazy guy, go off. My guess, my honest guess, you know, my pop psychology, you know, sort of way, is that there's still some strong resonance with the same sort of ideas that created the animal totem concept, where we identify with other living things and assign personalities and traits to them. And then, because we do that, because we've invested them with ourselves, we kind of choose the, you know, positive ones among them to represent ourselves. So the same reason, you know, not the school here, because they're Buckeyes, which are just poisonous nuts, which I think is hilarious, but, you know, most schools will have, you know, various school mascots that are animals. Like, we had the Panthers in my high school, which were pretty cool. That sort of thing. To answer the actual, like, question, out of those three, I mean, the Hounds are the only ones that I think would actually fall into that category. I mean, the Penguins are, the Penguin Mafia is a reference, which, I mean, goes back to the fact that penguins look like they're wearing tuxedos, really. You know, the Mafia wears tuxedos and kind of, you know, all cleaves together. And if I had to guess, I would think that, you know, Jumbucks was chosen because it's a really funny-sounding word, rather than as an actual explicit reference to sheep. But, so I would say mostly coincidence, but if you're asking why, you know, the Hounds are named the Hounds, other than, you know, voles just wanting to alliterate as much as possible, and already having the Hamlin thing going, I would guess because people kind of create these, this trait set for animals, and then try to invest that trait set back in themselves. That's my official answer for, you know, why humans have been, you know, going with animal totems since the dawn of time. Do you enjoy your week off for Christmas? I guess, will I enjoy my week off for Christmas? Probably not, honestly. Sad to say. I'm not much of a family person. If my family were holding a Christmas thing, I may or may not even go. They don't really anymore, since my grandmother died a few years ago. Since my grandmother went into a home many years before that. Everyone's very scattered, so it's not really... Everyone's kind of like their own little family. I actually sent my dad a present this year, which is very novel. I'm very proud of myself. I'm actually going to see my wife's family, down to celebrate with them, and that's gonna be crazy. It's gonna be my wife's parents, you know, my wife and I, one of my wife's father's previous wives, and they all get along, except for, like, normal personality things. It's not, like, a weird, awkward thing. It's just, you know, normal personality conflict. And then one of her kids from a previous marriage, and one of her kids with my wife's dad, and then, like, her two kids and one of her kids' boyfriends in a house. And, like, a good-sized house, but not that good-sized. And my wife's brother, and possibly his girlfriend. And, like, you know, everyone really endeavors to get along, but, like, one of them's autistic, and one of them's, you know, some of them have, like, other, you know, emotional issues, which really are just kind of, like, the match in the powder keg of just having that many people there to begin with. So that should be exciting. So, I'm not expecting to enjoy myself. I'll be pleasantly surprised if I do. After we come back, we're going to a New Year's party, but that's pretty much all we've got planned here in Columbus. Do you think you'll ever implement another type of techniques, and how did you arrive at the current neat system? If you look at the... net combat system. That's basically another system of techniques. As far as, like, another top-level type, like, you know, melee ranged, you know, fire, etheric, evade, all those, it wouldn't entirely surprise me if I did. There's nothing that's really calling out to me now, though. There's a lot of ground to mine there. Like, there's stuff that I haven't even scratched yet, without even doing any more coding. Just, like, a lot of concepts that haven't been touched on. The current system is, I guess, at the intersection of two ideas. What I was looking for in a combat system was one that wasn't just boring and repetitive. I'm going to pick on, you know, like, World of Warcraft here. For the vast majority of stuff in World of Warcraft, at least when I was playing, it might have totally changed by now, but I doubt that. You kind of have this rotation where you hit entangling roots and then, you know, hit wrath a bunch of times until, you know, the enemy finally breaks your entangling roots, and then, like, you wrath them as they run up to you, and then, like, you melee them or, like, moonfire them or whatever. And, you know, sometimes it's a little more interesting than that. Like, the Shadow Priest lineup was always kind of neat with, you know, the Mind Flay and everything. Enjoyed playing the Shadow Priest. But, as a side note, I haven't played WoW for quite a while. So this is, like I said, all probably terribly out of date. But, even in that sort of more immersive, like, you know, requires a little bit of, like, two-dimensional reasoning, not really three-dimensional. And actually, by two-dimensional, I really mean one. Like, you don't really... Well, yeah, so I'll say two-dimensional. Like, there's some positioning you end up having to do, even in solo content. Just so you know, you don't fear somebody into, you know, a crowd of other monsters and have them all run back to you. But there's very little variance. And I think that variance and striving against variance as the player is really a incredibly key part of really gaming as a whole. So what makes something like we'll say Magic, for another example, Magic Gathering, or any other CCG, really. What ends up really making that, for the most part, is you've got, you know, your deck, which, you know, is shuffled at the beginning of the game. And so there's variance in there, but both before that game, during deck construction, you kind of push against that by both, you know, how you build your deck so that, you know, the variance can't hurt you too much, and by the actual cards that you put in it, which may affect that variance in other ways, by letting you, you know, search your deck, by letting you, you know, look at the top cards of your deck, by just letting you draw more cards, which kind of melts the variance a little bit, but, well, shouldn't say that. By drawing more cards, you tend to bring the... tend to bring it closer to the mean, just, you know, statistically. And because of the nature of, you know, card draws kind of pushes that back together, too. So fundamentally what I wanted was something that allowed that. And I think you'll see that in a number of places in the game, where there are random elements which are random, and it's important that they're random. And it's also important that it's a little bit frustrating that they're random. Like, not a huge frustration, usually. I don't, you know, like actually dicking with people most of the time. But, like, there are... The randomness does something that's important. So, you know, you don't just go from, you know... you don't have, you know, five different colors of widget that all do the same thing, one of which you'll, you know, get every adventure, but, you know, there's a number of different encounters that you can get that actually have different effects, that actually do things. But at the same time, you can affect that randomness in a number of ways, both by changing both directly with, like, you know, the increasing various types of encounters, and by really turning on and off encounters, like the Walk with the Blind, you know, turns off the Blind Legion encounters, for example. So, you know, you can affect it that way. Like, you don't want those encounters, which I totally understand if you don't. You know, you can equip that, but they're not going to occur anymore. And then there's also, you know, the choices that you're provided, which let you affect that in another way. So instead of having, you know, four different encounters that do different things, you have one, and then four choices. And a lot of those provide you the option to basically reroll at a slight cost, you know, a fifth of an energy. So there's a lot of, you know, the randomness and then the struggle against the randomness. And, yeah, So I think that that's really important. And I also think that it not being the same every time prevents, or at least works against, this sort of fugue state you almost develop. And, I mean, you notice it in, like Kingdom of Loathing, Twilight Heroes, and in, you know, more complex games. EverQuest was actually terrible with this. Where you will, since your optimum strategy doesn't change substantially from, you know, moment to moment, encounter to encounter, you're basically just doing the same thing over and over. And so that just kind of, you just kind of enter this blur, which I'm not a fan of. I'm sure that there are people that really like just, you know, doing the same thing over and over in this kind of almost OCD manner, and maybe getting a reward, maybe not. I prefer to do different things and get the reward sometimes, sometimes not. I guess it's almost a stylistic thing, but I think that makes better games. The original EverQuest, though, I was just saying about that, it was so terrible at that. Like, the, and they had auto-attack, too, so it was basically, like, for many encounters for the first arc of EverQuest, I mean, they did a lot to fix it, especially in raid encounters and later expansions, but in the beginning, it was totally just, like, you know, hit auto-attack and, like, make yourself a sandwich. And, you know, for the same reason that, you know, it was not unheard of for one person to be playing, you know, six characters in the original EverQuest, an entire party. Because you could do it. There was just not... There was neither enough going on nor enough variance that would really require you to react in any way. But, okay, so that was the one thing. Like, I wanted that sort of variance and the, you know, fight against variance. The other half of that was... This is going to sound sort of strange, but, like, there's... there's, like, the variance to begin with, and then, you know, the fight against the variance. The fight against the variance isn't allowed to win. It isn't allowed to crush the variance, which is extremely important that doesn't happen. And there are a few tricks to do that. So, like, in most CCGs, it's really obvious. You'll see this doesn't... Like, you can't have more than three or four copies of card X in your deck. Which is their way of fighting against the natural and entirely healthy inclination of the players to reduce the variance as much as possible. Even though if they actually were allowed to eliminate, they would enjoy the game less. Okay, so that's how they do it. How I ended up deciding to do it was... inspired by Bait and Kytos, which is why I talk about this a lot. In Bait and Kytos, which is a sort of card-based system, the cards have numbers on them. It ends up working a lot differently from Metroplexity. But there's an idea in Bait and Kytos where if the cards you played and the numbers you chose, because there's a little a choosing mechanic too, but... lead to a certain, give you either, you know, a run, like if they go, you know, well, like a chain metroplexity, like 7-5-4-6, or whatever, 7-6-5-4, for example, or if there's, you know, pairs, or anything like that, you get, bonus damage, and so, mechanically, like, it's completely different for Metroplexity, but that was sort of the idea of creating those runs, was that basically created the allowed me to discourage having too many copies of one technique in a deck, basically. So if you put, you know, if you make half your deck, Crushing Punch, that's great, but you're going to get a lot of dead cards in your hand all the time, or at least like the vast majority of the time. So it encourages that sort of diversification, which allows the variants to work. And so, I get a lot of questions that are like, will we ever be able to reverse chains, or, you know, will you have techniques that, you know, count for multiple positions in a chain, that sort of thing, which are, like, obvious directions to take, you know, the chain mechanic, but fundamentally don't serve the base purpose of the chain mechanic. So, you know, if you have, you know, say a 5 that lets you reverse the direction of the chain, you play, you know, your 6 that you really wanted and you have a ton of in your deck, then you play the 5 to reverse and you play the same 6. And, you know, maybe play, you know, a 7 that reverses and then another, the same 6 again. It fights back again against that, and I think we're probably too without pretty seriously tweaking those concepts, and a lot of times making them really unintuitive. It's too close to eliminating the variants, which, like I said, is a natural thing to want to do as a player, but is terrible as a designer. Like, you may want to do that, but you're going to have to find another game. So if I find that the variant hasn't been eliminated, I'm going to fix it. That's coincidentally why we have a 15-card minimum on decks now, which we didn't originally. Because creating a 5-card deck, like, there's obviously a drawback, you know, if your enemies survive the round, you know, you're screwed, basically. But at the same time, that first round of combat is just soul-rendingly, stupidly boring. Not going to have it. Okay. So I guess I hope that answers the question. There's a lot of, you know, thought process there. So the current chain mechanic was actually originally envisioned as a clever way to make sure that you don't use the same technique a bunch of times in the same chain. It also, I think, really flows very well. There's a sort of narrative that it implies that's worked out pretty well, but it's not here or there, I guess. What aspect, element of the game are you happy with, proudest of, and which is the least? Let's see. Well, I'm really happy with what I was just talking about, the basic kind of mechanic and the techniques and how those play into, you know, the equipment and how that comes back and how, you know, that all links together. I'm also really pleased with, you know, the storyline, which, you know, we haven't got to see a ton of yet. Well, that's not true. We've got to see a fair amount, but there's still, you know, a lot of that to come. I'm a fan of the crafting, too, but I'm a complete crafting whore, so you'll have that. As far as the least, probably the user interface. I am not, honestly, very good with user interfaces. I'm not good with making things pretty so much. Or with making them, you know, use, you know, JavaScript, bane all my existence to do various magical things. So, there are places in the interface and just, like, appearance things that I'm not pleased with at all. Favorite ice cream flavor? You're going to get a weird answer for this, which is, right now, my favorite flavor, I shit you not, is goat cheese with cognac figs. I mentioned before that there are some pretty crazy ice cream places in Columbus. And right now, Jenny's, which is less dangerously now that it's winter, but really dangerously during the summer, is within walking distance of here, that has, like, you know, crazy, ritzy, upper-class flavors. And they had goat cheese with roasted red cherries. That got rotated out and replaced with goat cheese with cognac figs. They're both pretty flippin' amazing. So, which is good, because if they had replaced it with something that sucked, I'd have to find a new thing to order every time we went, and that'd be a sad state of affairs. The Mocha Chip from Greeners, which is another one here, is also fantastic. And I can never turn down root beer floats. So I guess for normal ice cream, I would have to go with vanilla, just because you can make root beer floats out of it. And they're not weird. Although, speaking of weird root beer floats, though, the same Jenny's, the crazy one, made a root beer ice cream for a short while. And they had a dry vanilla soda, and dry in that context, I'm led to understand, means that it's not sweetened at all, which is pretty weird. But they did a reverse root beer float with dry vanilla soda and root beer ice cream. That was seriously some of the most effed up stuff that I've ever tasted, but quite good, like in its own right. So yeah, if you ever come to Columbus, eat lots of ice cream, or you'll regret it. Is there a good reason that Walk with the Blind is a quest item, or will there be in the future? There was actually a question upstream. Oh, I'm sorry, I skipped over to Llama Man. There was a question upstream about the Blind Legion quest being implemented. That's why it's a quest item. You will need that to start the Blind Legion quest. I don't know 100% if it will remain a quest item once the Blind Legion quest is in, but I would rather have it be a quest item from the start and remove it later, if I'm able to, than have it start out as a non-quest item and then have to put the quest item on it. It's just a damage control thing, really. If I either A, didn't care about people's feedback, which, as much as I, you know, try to come off as a sociopath, I really kind of do, or if, you know, people wouldn't complain when I made things into quest items, which I don't expect will ever happen, I would have just created it as, you know, a normal item and then dropped it in as quest later, but for the moment, the quest, once Blind Legion quest is implemented, I'll be re-examining it to see if getting the book should be part of the quest during each reset or not. We'll see. Is there at present anything neat with the Book of Sailing Stories we have yet to find? I don't think so. It's mostly a bit of a explanatory-ness. It's not like a quest reward, really, or anything like that. It's just a bit of a bit of explanation of what's going on. I feel like at the moment credits don't have any worth. We need more money sinks in the game, like the Halloween event, or just money sinks in general, as well as expensive stuff to buy from NPCs, preferably consumable. The moment, there's not really a whole lot to spend credits on, so whatever value the credits have just continues devaluing, unless there's some stuff like this in the subscriber quest, in which case, rock on. There is a fair amount of upcoming stuff that will require credits in various capacities, but, like, really at the end of the day, I don't problem is more that people are not interested in buying things player to player than anything else. That people would rather just get it themselves, which is fine, don't get me wrong. It just drives the value of credits down a lot. So as we get a larger and larger store of rare items and items that have been rotated out, and et cetera, the value of credits will be reinforced because, you know, it's the currency for interplayer commerce. And it'll sink, you know, a little bit through Omnimal fees and so forth. But I just don't think that right now people are really spending their money player to player. So there isn't... It's going to sound strange, but, you know, even really bad credit inflation or deflation doesn't cause a problem, except in the mall. I mean, other than, you know, there's a huge number in the left-hand panel of your screen that doesn't do anything if things get, you know, inflated or deflated enough. But, so I think that basically it's just a matter of waiting for, you know, various rare items, items to rotate out and so forth to show up. Encourage, you know, economying. I hate to say it at some level, but I think that this is kind of a weird... I'm going to totally segue away from this question. But... So there's, you know, the items in the donation, all in Zach's, you know, House of Coins, that you can buy with the Unearthly Coins. And I think that those would fuel a lot of economic activity if they were rotating out. And, you know, with the threat of rotating out, I think there would be a fair amount of speculation on them. Which is interesting from a sociological perspective, I guess. Sort of a sandboxy type thing. But, you know, fundamentally, this is a game and not my personal sandbox. I guess what I'm saying there is I think that once the player base is large enough and enough people have donated, bought enough of the donation items to get, you know, a large enough pool of items that I can, you know, finally start rotating them out, I think that that will also help money flow, basically, the economy turn around. So, yeah. Let's see. Morwen. We already answered one for Morwen, but yeah. But Morwen again. The content is great, but the game mechanics are what make Metroplexity awesome. No, thanks. Do you have an inspiration creativity process, such as standing at your head and blaring loud classical music? Or more simply, how do you get your ideas? Do you have tons and tons of ideas, and the task is really to weed them out? Or do they spring fully formed? Do you have a vague idea that you need to refine for weeks? My process for it depends a lot on what I'm doing. Designing base mechanics is something that I really enjoy. But it's... I find it all kind of hard to actually describe. What I'll usually do is I'll sit there and just basically think really hard about it. Until either I feel like I've hit a wall or I have a mechanic that I'm settled on. And then if I hit a wall, I will start just typing up, like, stream of thought, a list of ideas. And that usually gets stuff worked out and gets, like, the pros and cons sort of sorted out. So those tend to more or less spring fully formed. They, how I usually end up getting to those is through an understanding of the needs that I'm trying to fill. So they, so like what I was talking about with creating the combat system with the chains, I had, you know, that need to create variance and to sustain variance. And that is really what drove that process. So we had like, okay, so I need variance in the combat system. Okay. Card-based combat. Love it. Creates the variance. Great. Okay. We're good. Alright. How are we going to restrict that card-based, you know, system so that, you know, the variance is maintained? Because you can't just, you know, if, you know, the chain system worked, but you could, you know, if it was just one card every round, one technique around, it would, you know, be totally different, right? It would, depending on, you know, it would need some other restriction to create the variance again, if that makes any sense. Because you could just put, you know, 30 of the same card in your deck, and it wouldn't benefit or hinder you at all. So that led me to, you know, the actual, it's like, oh, okay, you know, we have the numbers on them, and, you know, you create a chain of those, create a run, I was actually thinking at the time. And then, okay, and that both gets us both rewards for diversifying deck and creates, you know, an interesting avenue for completion, for deck construction, rather, and encourages each player to kind of find a sweet spot for themselves of, you know, risk versus reward, which is really cool. I like being able to do that. And I think when given that sort of choice, people find a better spot for themselves than they would if you just ask them, which I think is very interesting. So, like, if you go up to a gamer, the vast majority of gamers, not all of them by any means, the vast majority of gamers, if you ask them, you know, if they like randomness in their game, they will say no. They will, you know, rail on and on about how randomness is terrible. Periodically, you'll run into, like, an actual, like, designer or, like, armchair designer who will be like, actually, you know, randomness is really good. Or someone who's just really self-aware and realizes that they enjoy it. But that's the sort of... but if you give someone a game where they can trade between, they can up the level of randomness as far as they are comfortable and reward them appropriately for doing so, you'll find that most players will find a better spot for themselves. And that spot isn't zero randomness. I mean, you have to reward people to do it because having randomness is, I mean, it's never really beneficial. You know, you'd rather have, you know, your cake and eat it too than either, you know, have your cake or eat it. That sort of thing. Like, if there's, you've got, you know, if you're rolling a die, you know, just a normal d6, or you can just choose 6 every time, well, you know, you're just going to choose 6 every time. But if you can roll a die or get, you know, 3 every time, it becomes a little more interesting. Because technically, you know, average, you'll get 3.5. It's a little bit of benefit. Most people won't take that. Because it doesn't feel like enough of a benefit, basically. If you give someone, you know, you can either roll this die or take two. That's a lot more interesting. What you end up with there, most people will take the die roll. And rightfully so, because it's completely retarded not to, basically. But unless, you know, they just needed a two for something, in which case, what have you. But, so, anyway. Apologize for getting off on that entire additional tangent about randomness. It's something that really interests me, because, largely because of the psychology of it. And, like, there are some people who legitimately don't like randomness at all. I should say that. Like, I'm not saying that just because you're like, oh, I hate randomness. That doesn't necessarily mean that you're lying to yourself. Just in the vast majority of cases, people are lying to themselves about it. It would be sort of like if you're playing... Well, it's probably a bad example. But it would be the sort of thing like if you're playing poker and the deck was in the same order every time. Or like, you know, everyone had the same hand every time. It would not be a very interesting game. And similarly, like, Metroplexity, if, you know, you had the same hand of cards every time, it might be, you know, optimal. And people would do it because it was optimal. But it wouldn't make for a good game. Anyway. That tangent gone off on. As far as, like, other ideas, what I'll usually do for any sort of, like, quest design, which is really how I do things, you know, other than, you know, basic mechanics, I'll construct, you know, a quest for it. Those are the blocks I use to kind of build the game out of. Which, I'm going to go off on another tangent. You'll just have to deal with it. I apologize. Well, I don't really apologize, but, you know, whatever. There's a lot of different ways to design worlds. And not speaking of computer games specifically here, but tabletop RPGs, I think, show an interesting flaw in this regard. There's a lot of different ways to design worlds, which are basically determined by your basic building block of the world, you know, how you put the world together. Which is to say, like, are you building, you know, Legos or Duplos or, you know, wooden blocks or, you know, Lincoln Logs, whatever. As totally random aside, I kind of wonder if people in other countries have Lincoln Logs, and if so, if they're still called Lincoln Logs. Because I always thought that was a great pun, because you've got, like, you know, Lincoln, you know, grew up in a log cabin, whatever. Plus, you know, linking, because, like, they link together. Anyway, I had a bunch of them as a kid. I always thought that was a little clever. It's less clever now that, you know, I'm in my 20s, but it's still a little clever. Anyway. But, okay, so what kind of pieces are you building the world out of? And for my design, I build the world out of quests. So, you know, fundamentally, there's this understanding that the, you know, there's a lot of areas in Metroplex, a ton of areas that are, you know, the same size as, like, you know, Southside or, you know, the docks or, you know, Metroplex U. But you don't go to them. And it's not that you don't go to them because, like, they're locked off or anything. It's that you don't go to them because they're just not interesting. Like, they don't have anything going on there that, that you have a reason to go do yet. And, I mean, obviously, like, they're not designed or anything, but for the same reason. So there's that approach, and then... But there are a lot of other approaches to this. So, like, I've got my Legos, and then, like, the Lincoln Logs of a lot of tabletop RPGs, especially fantasy tabletop RPGs, is this sort of concept that you're building things a lot of times from a nation level. And this, I'm more or less willing to just blame this entirely on Tolkien. Because he had this sort of, you know, this really in-depth world narrative going on, that, you know, not to, to blaspheme or anything, but I don't think actually serves the story that he's trying to tell very well in a lot of cases. I mean, like, don't stop and describe the history of this hill because it doesn't fucking matter, right? But the a lot of the fantasy RPGs, because of that route, basically, have made the same mistake. And, you know, a lot of them haven't either. I don't mean to, you know, trash talk them for any reason. But a lot of times, like, you'll have Forgotten Realms that I will willingly, you know, trash talk this about. Or, you know, glancing at the bookshelf next to my desk, you know, Ravenloft also did this very badly. Mystara, if you're used to what really old-school D&D. Mystara. All did this, where they have this sort of, the basic level building block you're talking about is nation-state. Or, you know, maybe, like, a little city-state here or there, or whatever, you know, you got, like, your Waterdeep and your, so forth. Riverdale, or whatever it's called. Shadowdale? It's one of the Dales. That's important. Shadowdale, I think. So, like, the bricks that you have are nations, but you don't really, but the story is not being told at a national level. So, to choose, you know, another thing from my, you know, encyclopedic knowledge of D&D stuff, if you go back to 2nd edition, there is, I've just lost the name of it. What is this setting? Really cool setting. Okay, anyway, there's a 2nd edition setting, which was based around the concept that, you are a princeling, or, you know, a king, or a merchant lord, or something like that. Like, a really high-ranking person, you know, the blood of the gods flows through your veins, and you can, like, use this to draw power from the land. This sort of, like, very strongly medieval divine right inspired, but, you know, with elves and dwarves and stuff, because, you know, it's a D&D setting. And, you know, monsters. Because, really, it's a medieval setting. You need to have monsters. But, so, when you're talking about a game built at that level, the nation-state is really a good building block. Because, you know, either, you know, your entire party represents a nation-state, you know, taking on the various roles within it, or, you know, each member of your party can even be, you know, the ruler of a different state. Which is kind of cool. But when you're talking about something like Forgotten Realms, Ravenloft. Ravenloft is a little bit better for its own reasons. But just because of what the domains actually mean. But, like, the really traditional fantasy settings. Eberron does this kind of too. It's a little bit better at that. But the you have this sort of proliferation of states that aren't really, that don't serve the story. So, anyway, taking that back a sec. So, what I try to do is, I mean, why are, you know, we skipping around doing all this other stuff? Why are we building from organizations, which, you know, I would say are better generally than nation states, but still, like, why are we doing that? Or, like, building from characters, or building from, you know, classes, or whatever. When you can really build from the story, like, just chunks of story. I don't know why you would do that, honestly, but, you know, people do. I think Kingdom of Loathing actually does a really good job with this, too. I mean, their story is, you know, very funny and kind of, you know, ad-libbed at parts, but the areas are there, and are generally revealed to you, not always, but generally, as the story dictates. So, if you've got... So the world, I guess, and some of this is kind of retconned back in, from what I understand of the game's early history, but, you know, you're sent to, you know, the Goblin Knob. Is that right? No, it's Cobb's Knob. Goblin Knob is from Earthworld. You're sent to the Knob. and the, you know, the, that kind of unfolds, and the Knob is there because there's a quest there. And that sounds really artificial, but I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, it's better sometimes to be really artificial but tell a good story than it is to create this, you know, wonderful, synergistic, organic world and end up with something like, I'm going to pick on Blue Rose, which has a really nice world, like a really nice world, like anyone would love to live there. But there's, like, a bad guy. And, like, we're not talking, like, a Sauron bad guy, right? Like, we're talking, like, a guy, like, in the Senate who's a jerk. And, like, that's it. Like, that's all you got. Like, they're just... It's this really beautiful, you know, wonderful world, really well described, really, you know, kind of elegant in its own way. But, like, there aren't, like, bad people. Like, there aren't even... There isn't even really a lot of, like, friction or disagreement. So, that kind of... You know, it's like, if they designed that from the beginning to serve a story, they would not have made that mistake. Anyway, going back to the actual question for Morrowind. So when I go in to build basically anything else, I'll be like, okay, so here's the quest. Like, here's the survivor's quest. Okay. And then, this is going to sound really dorky, but I make a bulleted list. And the reason I do it like that is so that, I mean, I've got my top level, you know, quest lists, which are really where the survivor's quest. So I'll jump back to university quest. Okay, university quest. We've got the top level chunks. So I've got rescuing David, rescuing Dr. Amundsen, and basically getting the third eye to release them. Okay, so I've got those, and then I just basically think about all of them at the same time, and just, like, indent little ideas under them, and just kind of keep them in order underneath each heading. So, like, okay, so, you know, what's all going on here? Okay, so, the third eye, you know, why are they holding them? Okay, they're holding them because they were told that they have to hold them by the people who are supplying them Eclipse. Okay, so... To release them, you need to get a supply of Eclipse. Okay, you need to get a supply of Eclipse. Alright, where can you get the supply of Eclipse from? Okay, you can get the supply of Eclipse from Dr. Thomas. Okay, so, you know, you need to have gotten Dr. Thomas as a contact and, you know, done some stuff with him. Okay, great. And you need to have some contact with Third Eye. Okay, you need to get back into the VIP room. Here's how you get back into the VIP room. And so I do the... And then under each of those, you know, I would describe that. So, like, that's where the protest quest came from, to get back into the VIP room. And later, like, some extra steps were added in there to kind of beef up that path. But then, basically at the same time that I'm doing that, I'm also like, okay, so Dr. Amundsen, where's Dr. Amundsen? Okay, Dr. Amundsen is in, you know, the abandoned asylum underneath the labs at Metroplexium. Okay, so how do you get into the labs? It's like, well, how would, you know, the third eye protect something? Okay, third eye would protect something either with a bunch of bodies or with a, or with their own sort of security system, which I guess you'll understand what I'm talking about, having gone through that quest, but, you know, they're not gonna, you know, mount, you know, turrets on it or anything. They're all about Eclipse, so they've got that. Or, you know, you can blow down the wall, whatever, but... Okay, so we've got one, and then it's like, oh, well, you know, they also could post guards, so we'll put that up, you know, under David. So they've got some guards on David. You know, where's David? Oh, yeah, he's going to be in the abandoned building in Southside. That's why I put that there. Okay, great. I already decided on that. And so those just grow out organically from there until I eventually get down to, like, you know, what new enemies I need. Usually items tend to get filled in kind of towards the end, unless they're very plot significant. Stuff like that. So, I guess that's kind of my thought process there as far as the content goes. But the game mechanics is always from need. Alright, last block of questions. We've got Weird. Want to tell us when the snowman competition will end? If so, when? Well, let's say that there will be rewards for the snowman competition, and that there's a day when you normally get these sort of rewards, and it would be kind of weird to have the competition still going on while you were getting your rewards. Just saying. So that's my my vision of the future there for you. On a related note, if you haven't gotten a Christmas tree yet, get a Christmas tree. Seriously. You're going to be really pissed off at yourself if you don't. Ignore this question if the competition ends, precedes the podcast. Of course. Oh, okay. Well, it didn't. So, hey, that works out. Not sure if this has been asked before. Oh, wait, yes, but it was in reference to the reset board, I think. Anyway, will you preserve boards like the Snowman Competition one after events end? Maybe I'm confusing your podcast with theirs. I would like to... I'm not sure exactly where I'll end up putting them. I have a nefarious idea, actually. We'll see if that pans out. But, yeah, I would like to preserve, you know, that and the older beta reset boards as we move into new boards. So, hopefully we'll see those. Any podcasts you listen to? I have listened to the Kingdom of Loathing ones a couple of times. That's actually about it, though. I don't think I even have any other podcasts linked in iTunes. Well, it says I have 32 of them, so that must be... Oh, okay, yeah. Got the Kingdom of Loathing one. Yeah, the only other things loaded in here are random TV shows that pretend to be podcasts. Which is, you know, nice, because don't have to actually watch them, like, see commercials or anything. That's about it as far as podcasts go. I could probably, like, listen to some crazy gaming theory podcast, or, like, I don't know, do a crazy gaming theory podcast, because it seems to be the majority of what I talked about today anyway. But I guess I'll just save it from people asking about things. Oh, on a crazy gaming theory related note, actually, something interesting that I found out today is that I'm sure everyone who's, you know, wanted to publish their own book in the past couple of years has realized that, you know, in addition to PDF marketing being really good, there's a lot of, you know, really top-notch print-on-demand houses now. What I did not know until today is that you actually can get apparently quite good, I haven't, you know, seen it at all yet, but apparently quite good non-CCG card game print-on-demand, which is really quite interesting. I guess if anybody listening is the sort of person who compulsively designs things like I do, and you have a CCG you want to get published, there are apparently some good pod houses now for non-CCGs. I don't think they do randomization at all. So something more like Fantasy Flight Games, Living Card Games, which are actually pretty interesting if you want to go look at them. They have a neat model, I guess is what I'm saying. They're really good designers too, so I would not feel bad pimping their product. They had two properties that they had collectible card games for that didn't have enough volume to support that model anymore, basically, because you need a lot of sales to support a CCG, like a lot of sales. It's really kind of dangerous. Like, it's not a good investment really, most of the time, unless you've got some really just stellar property. They had Call of Cthulhu and Game of Thrones. So, we're not even talking, like, bad properties there. Those are pretty solid properties, especially among, you know, people who buy CCGs. But anyway, those had kind of fallen by the wayside a bit. And they started releasing them instead as what they call living card games, which is just non-collectible, customizable card games. So, you know, you buy your fixed box of cards and can, you know, build whatever you want out of it. And then instead of releasing expansions of, like, booster packs, you just get, like, you know, an extra deck that includes, you know, some cards for various, for all the factions. And then they also have just released, actually, I guess it's been a while, we're on, like, their second or third little deck lit. That's actually the other kind of cool thing. I'm just going to talk for a while. You can, you know, turn me off if you don't care about any of this. But a long, long time ago, so some of you might be familiar with a collectible card game by the name of L5R Legend of the Five Rings. It's, to the best of my knowledge, like the second CCG after Magic the Gathering, or something very close to that. It's certainly the second oldest surviving CCG. But they went through a phase shortly into their life cycle, and they also had a Doomtown, which is very likely the most fun idea ever. It's like steampunk cowboys with the ghost of Abraham Lincoln running the anti-paranormal agency for the U.S. government. It's even crazier than it sounds from that description, so, yeah, pretty funny. And I believe they had Rage at that point, too. I think that was the third game. But anyway, they tried a setup called Rolling Thunder, which was a really kind of interesting concept. Instead of having a large expansion every, like, 3 to 6 months, they were having a small expansion every month. And it had a really flat rarity scale. So instead of having, you know, commons and uncommons and rares, they just had commons and uncommons. So there were two things about this that led to it being just an utter debacle. Three things. One of them was that the distributors weren't even 100%, like, into the whole, like, CCG thing yet. So, like, this weird new thing, they had to educate them on it, and they didn't really care. So the people doing the distribution and, you know, the game stores doing the end selling really just kind of, like, kept buying it the way they used to, which, when you're talking about that much of a difference in distribution is a mistake, like a terrible mistake. But so that was a problem. And they also had an interesting issue where, so if you've got most game stores, you've got, like, you know, the huge section of CCGs, and the boxes just basically stay out there until they get sold. So if you have an expansion that comes out every 3 to 6 months, you've got, you know, a box that holds its spot, possibly for a really long time, but eventually it'll get sold out. But you're talking about suddenly you're multiplying the number of boxes and the amount of time, and really narrowing the amount of time before they start, like, clogging the shelves, which started causing them a lot of issues, like a surprisingly large number of issues, especially for someone like me who doesn't, you know, run a game store. People who run them might have been able to tell them about that in advance, but they didn't seem to realize that that might happen. But yeah, you just have, like, you know, like, 5-10 boxes, each with, like, a couple of packs in them, and it's kind of like, what do you do? Because people don't need to buy as many packs because of the flattened rarity. So that'll kind of perfect storm of badness there. But the third thing that was really interesting was that, as much as this kind of actually goes back to the randomness that we were talking about before. As much as people were really, when asked before they launched Rolling Thunder, people were really gung-ho about, like, oh, you know, rare cards are just, you know, a money grab, you know, we hate you, dying to fire sort of thing. Once they switched over, it was all, oh my god, where did all the rare cards go, you know, I used to, you know, trade all of my rares, you know, the people from the other clans to get, you know, the rares for my clan, and blah-bitty-blah-bitty. Just kind of, you know, people not realizing what they actually want. And there's sort of some insight there, I think, in that a lot of the people who play CCGs are also, you know, collectors at some level, or, like, have at least some enjoyment of collecting the otherwise unattainable, or the difficult to attain. But, yeah, so, and, but fast forward, you know, god, I don't know, 10 years, 15 years, something, large amount of years, and you've got these living card games that Fantasy Flight is doing now, and they're actually, releasing on a monthly schedule, as far as I can tell, for all three of these games, which is the same, and, you know, no rarities, really, because everything's fixed. Some, you know, you might get three of one card, you know, one of another card, but, since the item that you're getting, is a one-off, basically, it's working out way better for them, like, exponentially better, because Rolling Thunder was a complete debacle. It was, one of those, like, this is how you don't market a game examples that you get, almost drove the company under, which is really unfortunate, because they're good folks, but the, so you have this, but the new living card game that they're doing, since you basically have, like, the store will buy X decks of the new expansion, so they'll get, like, 3 decks of it, or, like, 10 decks of it, and, but since it doesn't come in, you know, a box with, like, 24 packs or whatever, there isn't that extra, you know, chafe to go through. It won't, like, clog up the shelves in the same way. And, interestingly, and I do mean this interestingly, they don't seem to be having the same problem with people complaining about the rarities going away. Which is kind of neat, if you think about it. I mean, and from, you know, the same sort of, the problem with game design is a lot of time you run into, like, you know, there's kind of this spectrum of game design. And on one end you have, like, mathematical game theory, which is fascinating, but, you know, tends to not make for very good podcasting. And on the other end you've got this basically, like, psychology, which I'm sure would result in me being punished by the people I know who have psychology degrees, but you'll have that. Okay, so, but it really kind of implies from that sort of latter pop psychology standpoint that people really don't like that being half-assed, which I think is interesting. Like, they would rather just get, like, their cards, like, the entire set, effectively, than worry about collecting them if there aren't going to be these, like, chase cards. So, like, the chase cards, the, you know, the rares, are exciting, right? And, but other than that, you know, like, the collecting and the rarity is kind of not worth the trouble, I guess? I don't know. It's an interesting question. But anyway, they seem to have hit on that. I'm not sure, like, from their funding perspective, if it's making as much money by any means as they would be if they were doing it still as a collectible card game. But that's kind of neat, and kind of segues, I guess, back into what I was talking about, having found out that there are pod houses for that'll do custom cards now, which is pretty cool. Okay. Anyway, now that I've rambled on about a completely different type of game for, like, I don't know, 15 minutes or whatever, I'm going to disconnect here, and hopefully we'll be back shortly after Christmas and aside from, like, maybe a little bit of stuff for, you know, maybe another holiday that might be coming up, I will be getting back into the Survivor's Quest, so hopefully we will see some progress on that. There might be some bits of it that I can release early, so we'll see about that. Or I might just, you know, dump it all in the other ones and hope that it's not too buggy. So we'll see about that. But yeah, it was nice talking. Signing off. I will see you on the forums and in the game. And thank you for playing. Thank you for listening. And Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. Happy Holidays. Enjoy your Hanukkah or Kwanzaa. Assuming Hanukkah isn't over already, which it might be. Kwanzaa might be too. Actually, I think it's the solstice today, isn't it, too? Yeah, happy solstice, and have a good one.